This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. Stephanie Nolan is a six-time nominee for the National Newspaper Award and a recipient of prizes from Amnesty International for human rights reporting in the war zones of Uganda and Sudan. She lives in Johannesburg, where she is the Globe and Mail's Africa correspondent. Her previous books include Promise the Moon, The Untold Story of the First Women in the Space Race, and Shakespeare's Face. Her latest is 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa. It's a terribly moving book wrought with up-close and personal sketches of 28 people, numbering one for the roughly 28 million people in Africa with AIDS. The book, 3495, is published by Knopf. Stephanie Nolan spoke with me from here in Vancouver.
Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Stephanie Nolan. Good morning, Ms. Nolan.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Why is AIDS such a pandemic in Africa? And is it? Do you think it's poverty? Do you think it's just neglect on our part as Westerners?
I think it's a whole great big mess of things, which of course makes the solution so much more difficult. It would be nice if there was one cause and then we could come up with one solution. It's that the disease was spreading for an exceedingly long time before anyone noticed. Well, lots and lots of people within Africa noticed, but there wasn't the infrastructure to do the kind of survey work that picked up HIV in North America when there was only two or three cases back in 1981. It spread because, I mean, obviously poverty is a huge factor. Lots of people are made vulnerable by the sex that they choose to have or sex they don't even get a choice in having because of their poverty. Poverty in the sense that so many people are migrant laborers and are displaced from their homes and from their families and then choose to seek sex or intimacy and companionship in other relationships that also make them vulnerable. Increasingly, we're finding out that there's pieces to this puzzle that we never imagined. For example, a very recent one is male circumcision, that there's lots of places where culturally men aren't, in sub-Saharan Africa, where men aren't circumcised or aren't circumcised until they're adults, so possibly after they've become sexually active. And we've just learned in the past couple of years that male circumcision offers huge protection against HIV. So when you put all of those things together, you get a recipe for the spread of the disease to the point where it got to 28 million people infected, largely without the outside world even remarking on it.
You live in Johannesburg.
I do.
You have a sense of the culture, the people. You travel throughout the continent. But AIDS certainly underlies everything. But politically, socially, the government, schools, getting clean water, all those things, they all seem to be, AIDS seems to be the common, I guess, the underscore, if you will, of life in Africa.
Well, you know, it isn't the cause of all the problems, but certainly one of the things that we've learned in recent years is that it exacerbates all of the existing problems. And that was in my efforts to convince the Globe and Mail that we should have a full-time beat reporter covering this. They were saying, well, why AIDS any more than any other disease? You know, why not have a malaria reporter or any other problem in Africa? And it's exactly those issues that you were just talking about. That, you know, I think we tend to sometimes think about Africa as sort of one big disaster that's sort of unchanging. And in fact, lots of the countries hardest hit by HIV were doing really well. 10 years ago, you had Botswana that had a higher life expectancy than Russia. And they've just had the knees kicked out from them by HIV. So it's reversing all kinds of gains that had been made in development. It guts economies because it takes away the productive generation of laborers. You lose the people, the doctors, the nurses, the civil servants, who would have been the backbone of your response to the disease. Lots of these countries are still primarily dependent upon agriculture, and they lose the generation that did the farming. And you also lose, I mean, something that's much harder to put a price on, you lose parents. You have whole generations of kids who aren't parented. You lose all of these sort of facets of your cultures, your societies, your communities. And, you know, what does that cost a country? I don't think we have a handle on that yet.
How do you think people from countries outside of Africa, how have they reacted to it, do you think? And you say something in the book that troubles me, and it should trouble everyone, that there seems to be a higher value for life in the West, in Canada, than there is for a life in Africa.
You know, I think that we don't... we have this perception because so much of what we hear in the media is about, you know, Africans in tragedy, Africans in terrible situations. I think somehow we started to think that those people put less value on their lives, and that if you live in a place that has a civil war or a famine or a drought or regular flooding or some combination of all those things, that you somehow, it's like less of a blow when you suddenly discover that you have HIV. And we think that, you know, we forget that those people have families and have kids and they want to see their kids grow up and they have ambitions, they have businesses they want to start or places they want to go. And that, you know, we forget that to find out you have HIV in Vancouver feels exactly the same as what it feels to get, you know, to receive that diagnosis, to hear those words in a clinic in Malawi.
You tell 28 stories in this book. And the number one for every million, there are roughly 28 million
people living
with
AIDS.
Yeah, you got to know a lot of these people, and it's a terribly moving book because you have such a great way of telling their stories. How does that affect you as a writer, as a journalist? You try to be objective, I'm sure, but you're obviously affected by this, even though you're not from there.
You know, I guess it's both things. It's obviously often really frustrating, makes me really angry because I know that these people, you know, if they were Canadian, would not be dying. And yet, it's also, you know, I mean, I spend a lot of time angry, and yet at the same time, it's also, strangely, my job is actually really exhilarating and filled with moments of just great hope and encouragement. And when I see the people who had, you know, almost nothing, who mounted just this extraordinary response to the pandemic, you know, sort of almost entirely ignored by the outside world, then it's, you know, spending a lot of these people in the book I'm lucky enough to now call friends, and spending time with them is just a really exhilarating, inspiring experience.
How are they, though, in terms of telling their... How were they in terms of telling their stories? Were they open to you? Did they find that they find it easy to talk to you?
Well, I don't know. I guess you'd have to ask them if it was easy to talk to me, but certainly there's nobody... You know, they were all willing participants in the book and understood what I was trying to do with it. You know, I guess it's one of the great marvels of this job is that people talk to you at all, let alone why are people willing to talk to you, you know, about their sex life, about the fatal illness that they have. People are sick people who are, you know, they're invariably gracious and kind and welcoming to me and patient and tolerant with all of my probing questions. And you know, sometimes they will, just when I'm preparing to leave, they'll sort of gently lay a hand on my arm and they'll say, if I lived in your country, I wouldn't be dying, would I? This wouldn't be happening to me. And, you know, that's obviously an uncomfortable moment, but people, nevertheless, I, you know, one of the things I marvel at is I think people know that if they live, I think people have a strong sense that if, wow, if this terrible thing was happening in your country and we could have done something about it, you know, we would have helped. Why don't people where you're from feel the same way? And that notwithstanding, you know, it gives the people a pretty good reason to be begrudging. That notwithstanding, they tend to be just incredibly welcoming.
How did you come up with the 28 people? I know Nelson Mandela is one of them. As a cross-section of the population in Africa, is that accurate, do you think?
You know, there's people who were there. I made a list of all of the economic, political, social information that a person would need to understand the pandemic, what I thought you would need as a layperson, and I went looking for people whose personal stories illustrated those facts. But I also, I went looking for the people who've been really influential one way or another to do with HIV, and Mandela was one of those. And I also thought, who are the most inspiring, the most amazing activists that I know, the people whose personal stories just really, really move me, and I made a list of them too, and you know, put together this sort of, it is ultimately a cross section. It covers 21 countries, I think, 21 countries, people who are maybe what we think of as the more stereotypical African, someone, you know, living in a grass hut in Mozambique, but there's also people in the book who have far more money than I do. You know, I mean, what they have in common is that they're all either living with HIV or living with the effects of it on their community.
We're talking with the Globe and Mail Stephanie Nolan. She's the Africa correspondent there and the author of 28 Stories of AIDS in Africa, 3495 from Knopf. Is it one of those things, and pardon my ignorance, where everyone is affected by this? You don't meet anyone who isn't.
No, that's not an ignorant question at all. You can't be. I mean, you can't live in a country where one in three people are infected and not have this touch your life, right? Like, there's no, maybe you don't have it, but when the infection rates are that high, if you don't have it, then your brother had it and died, and you have his kids, or, you know, you're trying to grow food for an extra 15 people because, you know, there's nobody left in your family to do the farming, or you're taking care of your wife, your sister, your next-door neighbor. I mean, there's just nobody anymore who isn't touched by this.
What do you think, then, will help Africans? What can we do to help? I mean, we can send medicine, but then you don't have the doctors there or the nurses or the people to administer the medication.
Well, you know, I guess it's important to say that there has been incredible progress with treatment, and yes, there is a desperate staff shortage of the people who are needed to do treatment, but at the same time, there's been a 13-fold increase in treatment in just the last 4 years, so there's now 1.5 million people on treatment, and that's, you know, increasingly they're figuring out how to get the drugs to people. You know, Canadians often ask me what they can do. They want to go, they want to help, and I often say, you know, think twice about going, because actually probably the thing that you can do that is the most used is at home. People say, I want to get involved, and I say, but you know, you're already involved, in fact, because the decisions that you make every day or things that are done in your name have a huge impact on the pandemic. A really good example is school fees, because I hear from people all the time who are concerned about orphans. They know there are 14 million AIDS orphans in Africa, and they want to know how to help those kids. They want to pay their school fees. And I say, well, that's great. That's very helpful. It's wonderful. I totally encourage you to do that. At the same time, ask yourself why those kids pay school fees, why they need to pay school fees. Their government charges them because the World Bank says they have to. Well, you know, who governs the World Bank? We do. Rich countries. Canada's a voting member of the Board of Governors. That's something that you can control, something you can have an impact on. I mean, not something you can control personally, but, you know, write your MP. I mean, it's an old-fashioned and quaint thing to say, but that's what brings the policy changes. You know, I mean, in South Africa, where people didn't have access to treatment for so long, what turned it around was a mass campaign of public action. And if you really care about the pandemic, well, get your neighbors together and pick one of these things and go to work on that. I mean, that's, you know, you don't need to go and work with the orphans in Tanzania to have a massive impact on the disease.
Unfortunately, for a lot of people in this country, unfortunately, they don't read your work in the Globe and Mail.
They don't read my work in the Globe and Mail. I'm shocked.
The only way they hear about AIDS in Africa is when celebrities like Bono or Bill Clinton, or they hear Bill Gates is doing something. Does that have an effect?
You know, I think it really does. When I compare the level of awareness there was to the disease when I moved to Africa to start doing this full time 4 years ago, I mean, people are far, far more aware now, and far more involved. People, you know, it's on the one hand a little bit troubling that you need to brand an iPod or a cell phone to get people to take on the greatest public health disaster since the 1300s. And on the other hand,
right,
if that's what it takes, you know, then fantastic. People have more awareness of what's going on and more of a desire to be involved, and it all helps.
Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today. Congratulations on this powerful and moving book, and continued good luck with it.